Well, I'm absolutely delighted to say that joining me on the Godcast today is Steve Nallen. Now, Steve is a writer, he's an actor, he's an impersonator, probably best known for his roles in the characters of Spitting Image. So I'm really delighted, Steve, to get you on the Godcast. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I'm very well. I'm looking forward to this chat. It's going to be good.
Whereabouts are you, Steve? Where's home for you?
I'm in North London. In Barnet. In fact, I'm on the last road in London. So beyond me, there's the M20. The next road is the M25.
Okay.
So I'm near South Mimms service station. For anybody who comes, down from Yorkshire, down the A1. And if it's the M1, it's a bit further. It's about 5 miles away. So that's where I am. And it's the north, the tallest part. It used to be the tallest part of London. In England, until you get to York.
Right.
So anyway, okay. You know, that's a bit of geography for you.
I know you're a Yorkshireman, aren't you? By trade. How long have you lived down south? Is South really home now?
Yeah, I think so, because I've got a bit of an accent, but not much left. I left Leeds at the university when I was 18 or 19, and I've never really been back. Stay with family over Christmas and all that sort of stuff. But no, I've never lived. I'm thinking about it. You know, I'm 61 now. So I talked to the family and they said, well, why don't you move back to, you know, sell your house in London, move back to Ilkley or Whitby, you know, somewhere like that, which sounds nice. I wouldn't mind doing that.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're on the verge of this exciting venture with your book that's coming out. How are you feeling about this time? Are you nervous, excited?
It's a weird thing to, you know, the book and stuff. It's a weird thing thinking about the fact that somebody might be reading what you've written. Because when you're on stage, you know, you're performing, you're there and it's live. And even Spitting Image, when I was doing that show and other shows, you knew from 10 o'clock till 10:30, somebody was going to be watching it. But it's slightly weird when you think about, you know, that there could be anybody just reading it right now. It's just, it's a bit odd, really. Anyway, if they are, I hope they're enjoying it.
Yeah, this book is The Time That Never Was. Here's my copy, which you very kindly sent to me. Is this something that's been long in the ether?
You know,
I've been in there.
I think for probably 50 years.
Wow.
Because I always loved stories. I'm very slightly dyslexic. I've never been tested, but I am slightly, I know I am because of the way I look at numbers and stuff. And when I was about 14, I used to deliver the Yorkshire Evening Post. And every time I went on a newspaper round, I used to invent a story. That's what kept me going. And in fact, I invented a story Monday to Saturday. And then there was a cliffhanger at the end of each day. But I was not good at writing. You know, I was a terrible speller. I couldn't write. And when I wanted to write stories at school, what I used to do was I used to write the chapter headings, chapter one. And I knew what happened in the story, but I knew that, you know, actually writing it was going to be hard work. And I just didn't think I could do it. And then somebody said to me, I thought, I'm not a great writer. But somebody said, yeah, but you're a good storyteller. Mm. You know, you can fix the writing. It's harder to fix the storytelling because you're a great raconteur and storyteller. So I that's why I did it. And we'll talk about it, I'm sure, in a minute. But, you know, and what happened was a few years ago, I got an E. coli infection. And it kept me awake for 6 nights. And we know when you're kept awake for, you know, that length of time, your brain starts going a bit doolally. And then suddenly in the middle of the night, I had an idea and I thought, this is a really interesting idea. And then I thought, I'm going to write it. I've always wanted to, you know, write a big story. So, and that's what I did.
Can you remember the day when you sat down and wrote the first page? Can you recall?
Well, actually, I do. Oddly enough, I planned the whole thing out in my head and on notes, so I knew exactly what happened. And I actually didn't start on the first page. I started in the middle of the story. And P.D. James, the crime writer, says the same. She said she never begins on the first page. The first page is really hard. to write because you want it to be perfect. And she said, don't start on the first page, start in the middle of the book. And don't worry about what it sounds like. Mm. So that's what I did. I thought that was very good advice.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I do. And I sent it to a neighbour who's sadly no longer with us. And I thought, well, if she likes it, she's a very honest woman. If she likes it, then I'll keep going. And she loved it. And she said, I want more. And so that's how it slowly progressed. It took about a year to write.
Mm.
And I essentially had to take a year off to do it.
So somebody who's been on the Godcast, Steve, was Jeffrey Archer, who is a prolific writer, who said he still found joy in sitting in front of the computer with the story, but not actually knowing quite where his imagination would take the story. Was that the same for you?
No, mine's a mystery story, and you need to know the end of the mystery before you tell it. And I've also worked with writers, playwrights, and I've worked with playwrights who've written Act One not knowing what Act Two, what happens in Act Two. And I thought, well, how can you do that? And I think, put it like this, you need to know what happens, but not necessarily how it happens.
Mm-hmm.
So the imagination stuff can change. And actually, I was writing the book and I realised there was a huge flaw in the book. At 1 o'clock in the morning, and I spent the next 5 hours till 6 o'clock in the morning working out how to solve this problem. And I took the day off after that.
So this book is it's the first of a trilogy, isn't it? And
yeah, book one that is there now, and book two is written and completed, but it needs editing and so on. And then I've still got to write book three. I know how book three ends, so I know how the whole, but I don't quite know how it ends. You know, I know what happens, but sort of not how it happens yet.
Are you chomping on the bit to get on with that third book, Steve? Or
editing and proofing and sorting, you know, everything out. It just, you know, it takes forever. And it's actually months now since I've actually sat and written. That's what I'm looking forward to. Yeah. Getting back to writing book three.
So this book, tell our audience a little bit about it. It revolves around what's known as the Swidges, and you've got a wonderful website that backs this up and that people can go and take a look. But tell us about the Swidges and William.
Well, I tell you what happened. To cut a very long story short, it was my 50th birthday. This is how the origin of the story in a way. It was my 50th birthday. And I came home and a tile from the roof fell in front of me. And the guy said, if it had fallen on your head, it would have chopped your head off because it's an old house, big. And I said, was I sort of 10 seconds from death? He said, yes, you were. And then I thought, well, you know, there might have been somebody I met on the way who stopped me, said hello, and as a result of those 10 seconds, I was saved. And I thought, well, supposing there is Swidgers, that they sense an accident is going to happen to somebody, and then they slightly knock them over, or they say, oh, can you light my cigarette, or what's the time? And that 10 seconds saves their life or some sort of accident. And that was the germ of it. I live in an area where loads of schools, and there was one day was a lad was running for a school, and he might have been late or whatever he was, and there was a sharp turn, and he didn't see a huge van coming. And my instinct was I just grabbed him by his blazer and pulled him back, and he was within a split second of being hit. He just didn't know that the traffic was coming. And so I swidged him. You know, I just stopped the accident. And I thought this is an interesting idea. And then I sort of just then developed it from there. The Swidges never know what the accident's going to be normally in my story. They just fix the time. So it's all about time. It's all about fixing the time. It's almost as if the universe at the beginning of creation, the universe and time were slightly out of joint, put out of joint, and that's sort of what I've developed, this sort of story where at the very beginning of creation, it should have been, the world should have been perfect and the universe should have been perfect, but time was just put out of joint, so the Swidgers are here to fix it.
Yeah, and tell us about William Arthur, the character. So tell us a little bit about him and
well, how he's Swidgers are never noticed. They don't want to be noticed. But he's not daring. He's not imaginative. He's just one of the, he's got this Swidger energy that just makes him not trick people up, but just pull them or whatever to stop. And that's all he does. He's not interested in doing anything. That's his purpose in life. But then something happens, and then a character comes along. We can talk about her in a minute, and says, "That's ordinary Swidgers. You're different. There's something different about you." And every so often, the Swidger world, as it were, create what they call a hopeful monster that's going to do something really, really special with time. And he is that special Swidger.
Yeah.
And it's me, really, because, you know, when I was a kid, I was at the back of the class. I didn't say anything. I was, you know, I wasn't well known, or, you know, I didn't play football. I wasn't particularly bright. I wasn't, you know, I was just the ordinary kid at the back of the class. And the character that comes on, she has to turn him into something a bit special. So she takes him from somebody who's not remotely daring or imaginative to somebody who has to be daring and imaginative.
Yeah. And this other character, I presume you're alluding to, is Granny.
Well, I realised that, you know, if you're going to have this sort of young lad, that you know, you need the
Gandalf equivalent. I'll do my Ian McKellen for you, just to say hello. I'll do my Ian McKellen. You need that.
Or you need, you know, you need Professor McGonagall, you know, from Harry Potter, and Miss Maggie Smith. You need a character like that.
So I thought I'd use my own grandmother, and I'll call her Granny. She's not his grandmother. She's just called Granny, and she's this really eccentric, fun character who turns him into a, you know, the more daring and more imaginative, but she always does it in a funny way. That's the thing about books. I've read a few books, and they're on my shelf at the back, and they're great books, but they're not funny. And I've lived for 50 years. I began on the Northern Clubs as a comics impressionist, and I thought there aren't any funny books, so I just wanted to make her as funny as possible. And that's what kids have loved more than anything else. They just love the fact that she's so irreverent and she, there's no point in being daring unless you're fun, having fun doing it. That's the point.
And was your granny funny?
I think she, in the book, Granny tells very unfunny jokes, but she doesn't realise she is funny.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? That she tells really, really bad jokes that she laughs at, but she has no understanding that she is hilarious. And she gets cross when people start laughing because she doesn't understand it. And that's sort of based on... the Granny character is based on... And in fact, I've got a picture here. Probably won't see it very well, but I put this up. These are all my grandmothers. The lady in the sort of sepia colour, the tallest one is the grandmother who brought me up. That's my father's mother, who used to like to show a bit of leg. She was a lovely, lovely, loving woman. My mad auntie, Janie, with me, I can't see that very well. And then there's my aunt Marjorie, who helped bring me up. So they're all in her, you know, they're all in her.
Yeah. If you're watching this on YouTube, you'll be able to see those images. But if you're listening to this via the podcast, then you can see those images on your website, Steve. They're the same.
Yeah, they're all on the website. Yeah. But if you go to, it's called Curiosities and Trivia. And there's loads and loads of pictures of Granny and loads of other stuff as well.
Yeah. And, I'm in the process of working on a book, Steve. Just tell us a little bit about that process of, you know, there's so many people out there who love writing, don't they? But it's not always straightforward getting a publisher, is it?
Pretty much every literary agent in London. I've got again. I find them for you, I will. But I think it's... Oh, here they are. That's the collection of literary agents I sent the stuff to.
Gosh.
And they all said no. And, you know, that took months to sort out. And what I eventually did was, I thought, right, the literary agents don't like it. Let's get it into schools. Let's see if the kids like it. And so I rang my neighbour as a teacher, and I knew another teacher and a teacher in Manchester. So I said, look, will you get your kids to read it in reading groups and stuff? Yeah, sure. They loved it. And they wrote really nice things about it. And then I sent them to the literary agents. Look, this is what the readers have said. And they still said no. Mm. So I thought, okay. But eventually we did find a publisher. It's too complicated to go into all that. But it was sort of 128 no's and then one yes. And you only need one yes. You only need one left, yeah. One yes. Yeah. And I was very lucky to get it.
Yeah, I think there's a key message in there about keep going, particularly, you know, if you're an aspiring author, because somebody says no, it doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad book, does it?
No, absolutely. Well, hopefully not. I mean, it's and the kids liked it, you know. But I think the thing is that I watched a thing on YouTube recently with a literary editor who basically said no literary editor was looking for Ulysses. The point being that when something unusual and different comes along, they don't recognise it. They want something that they're familiar with, something that, you know, they can put on the shelf because they can, that, you know, it's the same as somebody else has written. When something a little bit unusual comes along, and my book is, people say it's really weird in a good way, but it's really, it's not your normal stuff that gets written. It's difficult to say whether it's a fantasy or science fiction because it's based in the real world, but there's an element of fantasy in it, but there's no magic in it. It's not a magical story. There's no vampires in it. There's no, you know, it's and there's no time machine in it. It's not clear actually exactly how all the time shifting stuff happens. I know how it happens, and it does get explained, but so it's not a science fiction story with a TARDIS and stuff. So it's not an easy book to put on a shelf, but that's why the kids liked it, because they said, look, it's got comedy, bit of science fiction in a way, it's got fantasy, it's got a little bit of not horror, but it's a bit of danger, it's got mystery, and it goes from one to the other. It's funny, then it's odd, and they love the mixture. So maybe, I don't know, literary agents just didn't get it, so there we are. And I think what I would say to directly to write, just write. And actually nowadays I came to a think it was going to be sent to a publisher, and if this publisher doesn't want it, I'll self-publish. It's not difficult to self-publish now.
No.
Get your book written and get it published.
Yeah.
Because do it yourself. And it's not, you do something called print on demand. Amazon run it. And you need a, you know, I forget what it's called now, an IS something number. And you it's easy to do. It's not difficult.
Yeah.
And not expensive.
No. And Steve, you talked about that that near-death experience. Is the book in any way semi-autobiographical? Is you know, have you called on your life experience for this book?
I think that it's my grandmother. I ran away from home when I was 14. My father was he had schizophrenia. My mother died when I was 9. She just came home one day and died. And it was that moment I thought my entire life has changed. I just remember, because I saw her body coming out the house, and that's it. My life is now completely different. It's on a different track. My father was schizophrenic, so we lived with him for 5 years. It then became impossible. An evening or two before Christmas, back in 1974, when I was just 14, me and my sister just ran away from home. We didn't know where we were going to go exactly, but we ended up at my grandmother's, and she had an attic. And the house was condemned that she was living in. It was slum clearance, and it was due for demolition. So for 2 years, it took 2 years to get rid of us. We were the last family in the street. I lived in the attic with my sister was there, and my auntie, who was in this little two up, two down. It sounds a bit like the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. country, but you know, the family in there. But I don't want it to sound like poverty poor, and I don't mean it like that, because I regard my grandmother as my rescuer.
Yeah.
She rescued me. I don't know what would have happened had we have stayed with my father, because he was really, you know, not at all well. I still kept in contact with him, and I, at his requiem mass, he was a Catholic. I did the eulogy, so I never lost contact with him or anything like that.
Yeah.
But no, my grandmother was my favorite. And my grandmother was born before the Titanic sank. So here I was in the 1970s, a teenager, being brought up with a woman who was essentially an Edwardian. And she'd lived through two world wars. When she was 10, that was the middle of the First World War. She had two kids in the middle of the Second World War. She was a tough, tough lady. And she'd known true poverty. And so if I complained about anything, you don't know what you're talking about, Stephen. You don't know what you're talking about. You don't know you've lived, you know, just, you know, you can't. And it was tough love. She wasn't a big lover and kisser and all that sort of stuff. My other grandma was, you see, this is the point about granny in Swidges. Mm. She's a sort of composite of all of them. Mm. One grandma was tough love, the other one. As soon as you walked in the house, oh, come here, Stephen, give us a big love. Give us a big love. Oh, you know, which.
But Stephen, that's not that's not an easy start to life, is it, for a young guy? Did that affect you in later years? Did you have to go through a process of unpacking all that? Or
I think it took me, well, it took me 10 years to cry about my mother's death. You know, we lived in that. You've got to be tough. You've got to be a big boy now. We didn't go to the funeral. We were taken to see Hello, Dolly. And it was all pretended that the funeral never happened. All these, I think these were adults that made mistakes that we should have been told what was happening at least. And we shouldn't have been lied to. And that's the thing, that I was lied to by adults who should have known better. And I knew they were wrong. So that stayed with me. You know, I've been less trusting of people over the years because of that. And we weren't encouraged to show emotions and all that sort of stuff. And then when I was a student at university, in the first year I came back, and I remember chatting to my grandmother very late at night. She'd lost... she'd lost her daughter. And I'd lost my mother. And we had a real, I don't know what you'd call it, a shared grief. I cried like crazy that night. And so I waited 10 years to do it. And actually, I'm sort of getting a bit upset now, but I think when you have a big cry, it sounds an odd thing to say, but I think once you have what I would call almost a primeval cry for somebody that was so important to your life, you then can move on. But I've met people in my life who've never done that. And so I really encourage people to talk about things, to get those emotions out, to cry when you need to. And it helps with where, you know, that's the nature of stuff. But I had this unique bond, I think, with my grandmother, because of, you know, the maternal daughter connection.
And you talked about your dad being a Roman Catholic. Has that experience influenced your perspective of faith matters? Are you a spiritual person, Steve, or? Are you?
Well, oddly enough, I think so. And there's a spiritual side to it. It's a secular spiritualism. I love this. I went to a Jesuit school. My father took us to Novena on a Thursday, confession on a Saturday, and Mass on a Sunday. So we were in church three times a week. Because his schizophrenia came out in a particular type of Catholicism. So I struggle a bit with that. At school, we did the saints and stuff, and somewhere along the line, I came across, I think he's called Saint Irenaeus of Lyon, and he wrote that you will find God in a man fully alive. And okay, it's slightly sexist, but you know, let's say nowadays you will find God in a human being fully alive. And I just think that is the most wonderful expression of what God is. That life enhancing, living your life to the fullest. And that can mean writing stories, loving your children, doing what you're doing, going out into the community and making a difference. That's something I can't do what you do. I don't have that in me. It's just not my nature. But what I try to do in the book is have these characters make a difference, a small difference to somebody's life, but get them to make a difference and let them witness it. And there's a scene in the book where, I won't go into details, but somebody gets to be fully alive because they do something really wonderful for their orchestra in the school orchestra, and the pupils play incredibly well, and Granny makes a difference there, and she said, look, that's a man fully alive. That's what we're here to do. And she has this wonderful expression. She says, Swidgers are here,
you see. The reason why Swidgers are here, love. The reason,
that's how she's going to talk in my book.
The reason why Swidgers, we're here to help them sing the song they're meant to sing.
And that, I don't know where I got that from. I might have made that up. I just love the idea of God being found in a person fully alive. And if we can help each other to sing the song that we're meant to sing, then we're doing God's work.
Yeah, very nicely put, Steve. Thank you. Steve, you've thrown in a few voices there already.
Let's do Margaret Thatcher. We haven't done Margaret Thatcher.
Where did you get I can't do impressions, but I can do accents quite well. And I've always loved the rhythm and of sounds of people's voices. What was the first impression you did when you thought, oh, I can do voices here?
Well, we at school, I remember somebody said to me that started doing an impression of Brian Clough, you know, the old Derby County manager. And he said, I can do Brian Clough. Now, you see, what you do is you hold your nose like that, and that makes you do Brian Clough. And I said, that's interesting, but I can do Brian Clough without holding my nose. They said, how'd you do that? I said, I don't know. And then, you know, other voices, you know, came along back in those days. I can't remember who I was doing. I was doing prime ministers, you know, people won't remember.
People won't remember people like...
that's what I did at school. My teacher, we did Noah and the Ark, Flanders and Swans, Noah and the Ark. And it's so written that you can do anything, really. So the people of Noah's village were
sent their leader, and it turned out to be Harold Wilson.
And I can tell you the first joke I ever told on stage when I was about 15, I think it would have been. And it's quite a good joke, I think.
He said, you see, now the problem with Noah's God is he is interested in confrontation. Well, he introduced the six-day week for the start.
Now, actually, you know, that's a quick, a nice little gag.
Yeah.
That was the very, very first gag I ever told. So it was a God gag in a Jesuit Catholic school.
Yeah.
So it wasn't massively strict, but and it's a good gag. I thinking about it the other day because Johnny Walker, who was my English teacher at school, and he died some years ago, but I've sent a copy of the book to his widow Mary, and because he was, you know, that's okay, I had no mother. I had my grandmother. That was great. But my father was absent. And I've realised what you do is you gravitate towards the mentor that you want.
Yeah.
Or you need. And Johnny Walker was my mentor at school. He was a good man, a kind man, and very funny and slightly irreverent. I pretty much all my values I got from him.
Yeah. And how soon did you know that you wanted to be in showbiz, for want of a better word? How soon did you know you'd
be? I don't know about the showbiz thing, because I didn't realise that. I didn't think it was possible. We had the Northern Clubs. That's all we had. So I used to see acts doing stuff. And that's how I started, performing. My grandmother would take me to. I couldn't get. I was too young to go to pubs. So I said, "Look, can you take me to a pub?" So I can do talent shows, which I started when I was about 15. But I'd always dressed up. I had a scarf, and every scarf, every position of the scarf would produce a different character, and I'd make stories up and stuff like that. That was from the age of 5 onwards. So there was. I don't think there's ever a doubt of what I was going to do. I just didn't know how to do it.
Yeah.
But you'll find a way. You find a way. Listen, I'm going to be honest with you. There's a lot of egotism in it. Let's not pretend that there isn't. To get up on stage and say, "Listen to me, I'm going to be funny or do a joke," there is a lot of egotism. But at the same time, it's weird. There's always self-doubt. It's this weird thing that you want the attention, but at the same time you're very doubtful. And I'm not going to mention who it is, but I've only met one performer in my life who seemed to have no doubt about his own talent. Mm. Everybody I've worked with has, after they've done a take, they look around to see what everybody's reaction is. Even the very, very best comedians I've worked with.
Yeah. Steve, one of my heroes is Les Dawson. I'm a huge fan of Les Dawson.
I met him once. Lovely man.
And you played in Sissy and Ada. Is that right? What was the appeal of that? Was it that characterization that Les brought to his?
Well, I was so they did the Sissy and Ada, and I knew sadly died Barry Cryer. And what used to happen was when he was. When Les was at Yorkshire Television making Says Les, he and Roy used to improvise their grannies to each other between takes. And Barry Cryer overheard this going on one day. So what are you two doing?
Oh, well, we're just improvising, a bit granny, a bit improvising.
That's right. I'm playing this character, you see, who's a slightly posher than Les's character. You know, she drinks sherry.
Well, I drink stout.
And I said, "Lads, this is a sketch." And that became Sissy and Ada. And when you watch the Sissy, we don't get stuff like that nowadays. But they were just funny, you know. And being from Leeds, you're the other side of the Pennines, but we all recognise Sissy and Ada. And there was joy in what they did, and when Les and Roy used to do it, you could see them laughing with each other and enjoying it, and they did it with such affection and love, and a play was written which was about the relationship partly between Les and Roy and stuff, and one of the most wonderful moments was we did the show at the Lowry. And in Manchester or Salford, and Les Dawson's daughter came to see it. And she said the most wonderful thing afterwards. She said, "Thank you for giving me 2 more hours with my father."
Oh, gosh.
Well, Eric Potts, who played Les, was, it was just, yeah. And it was the affection, Okay, let's say something. There's a special northern warmth in the humour, I think, without being unpleasant to anybody else. There's a special northern warmth, which I'm not quite sure always is achievable if you haven't been born in Lancashire or Yorkshire. That's my opinion.
Yeah, I think that's true. And that was one of the reasons why I don't watch Coronation Street anymore, but I used to love that for the same reason. Those rich comedy northern women, you know, the Bette Gilroys, and they were just wonderful characters, weren't they?
Well, they and Granny in my little book, she's in the Hilda Ogden-y, Ina Sharple. Mm. She's a mixture of all those. And I've stolen a line from a very old Coronation Street. I'll admit that for Granny. But I watched it, blow black and white one, and Hilda Ogden is saying, "I'll tell you this once, because I'm not the sort of woman who boils me cabbage twice." That's a wonderful line. Mm. It's poetic. Mm. And I found another one which I did some research. You know, the mills in Lancashire. Don't just stand there like cheese at ninepence.
I love it. I do. I love it.
And you know, this sounds pretentious, but it's poetry. From
beautiful. It is.
It's beautiful. Just stand there like cheese at ninepence.
You couldn't write it, could you?
That's the point. You couldn't write it. You have to listen.
Yeah.
You have to listen to what people naturally say. I'll say this one because I'm not the sort of woman who boils me cabbage twice.
And Steve, talking of strong characters, you made the role of Maggie one of the strongest characters, your own. I can see Spitting Image now. It was incredible. And I think you took Maggie to a different level. You know, I remember the likes of Janet, was it Janet Brown?
Janet Brown, yes.
And Faith Brown, who both did that character. But you brought, I think what you brought maybe was a bit of... I don't know what.
Well, I brought an edge to it, I suppose. Janet, I knew very well. We got on incredibly well. We met at a theatre, and I introduced myself, and she was. I know her son very well, Tyler. Tyler Butterworth, and she was lovely. But you know, the caricature of the Thatcher character needed an edge. That's not what the wonderful Janet Brown did. I'm going to move away from the mic. So I took the voice of Thatcher that she did in the House of Commons. The right honourable gentleman doesn't understand the nature of fiscal policy. He does not understand the nature of European policy. And he doesn't. And I then turned that into the way Mrs. Thatcher dealt with the cabinet. And of course, you could also be very, very gentle and very, very persuasive. And then suddenly, you're idiot! Stop messing about! It's like Punch and Judy. Mm. And I sort of realised that, without going obsessed with my grandmother was an alpha woman, and Mrs. Thatcher was an alpha woman. I don't get on with alpha men particularly well, but I love strong women. I love the Ian Sharples and the Hilda Ogdens and so on. And I realised that, they said, why do you think you're good at doing Mrs. Thatcher? I said, because I'm attracted for some reason, psychologically, to strong women. What's wrong with that? And it's continued because, you know,
I think I do Maggie Smith at Downton Abbey and Widdicombe. And you can't get more alpha woman than Anne Widdicombe.
Yeah, she's a great, she's another wonderful character.
I do the women better than the men, you see.
And did you like Maggie? You know, what was your... I don't think you met her an awful lot, did you? But what was your relationship?
No, she was in the same room once, but we never met. I don't think she got... She understood money, okay? She understood money. I don't think she understood communities. I just don't think she got that whole world that, you know, you can argue about the pits closure. Mrs. Thatcher, Harold Wilson closed more pits than Mrs. Thatcher did. And you can argue that when the pits were closing, the Industrial Revolution was coming to an end, and so on and so forth, and coal was coming from Poland, it was Michigan. So the financial side of it, you could say, okay, I understand that. She never, ever understood the importance of a community, that when you remove the primary industry of that community, you are threatening that community. And she never put enough support in to help that transition. Okay, the pits were going to close and possibly some of the big industries were going to close because they've stopped building ships in Newcastle and they now build them in Korea, whatever it was. Okay, but you've got to support the community. And I still think, we're now still living with the effects of that. That's my opinion anyway.
Steve, I've thoroughly enjoyed talking to you. It's been a real pleasure and joy for me. What's obviously you've got the excitement of the book. What about live performance, Steve?
I'd like to. I enjoyed touring. I'd never toured before until a couple of years ago, and I did a big tour, and I loved going. I love going to Minster's, and I love stained glass windows. And oddly enough, yesterday, it's a complicated explanation, but I was actually invited somebody who lives, a friend of mine now lives in Westminster Abbey. He said, "Do you want to come to the Abbey?" What? So, yeah, I live there. You live there? Yeah. Wow. And so he took me around the Abbey, and I just, I don't know what he is, you know, that I've got candles in my house. I love candles. And somebody came into my house and said, "You Catholic?" I said, "Yeah, how did you know? You've got candles." You know, you go to church three times a week, Steve, when you're 7, 8, 9, whatever. Novenas and confession and mass on a Sunday. It's candles. You just get used to the smell, and so I've got candles everywhere. You know, proper
candles.
Proper candles. Yes.
Yeah, fabulous. Well, listen, I really wish you all the success with the book. And I really hope that people pick it up and read it, and it does tremendously well. And just thank you so much for your time, Stephen. And we send our love from the north down to Barnet, and say thank you for coming on the podcast.
And I say thank you very much, and find God in a person fully alive.
God bless you. Thank you, Steve. Thank you.